Okay, let's talk a little bit about networking and what it is we're trying to accomplish here with the network administration class. First of all, what is the purpose of a network server?
To provide services and information to users.
Okay, so to provide services and information to users. Anybody have any other definitions? What's the purpose of a network server? Makes it easier to collaborate. Okay. Say that again? Store data. Okay, it allows us to store data or centrally store data. What else? What are we going to do with that data after we store it? How might we open it up? What are some of the ways we might utilize that data? Okay, so we could share the data with other users in different locations from their workstations. Okay. How might we share it? Think of some examples. Okay, if we shared it over the internet, how do we usually share data over the internet? Okay, we could deploy a web server that would give users access to data. And just to kind of add to that, we could provide both public access and limited access via the web server. What's another way? As a user, what's another way you might use the server to manage your data? I'm sorry?
Map drives.
You might map drives to central data? Okay. You might have shared storage
and shared access. Like if you have a group of people that are basically working on the same project, you can simply use like a single data file that several people can write to.
So like if we had the marketing department working on a project,
right,
we could create a folder or directory out there for the marketing department. We could give everybody in the marketing department access to that data. We could map a drive on their workstation so that every time they logged in, Drive M was the marketing department shared data, and they could have databases, they could have spreadsheets, they could have word processing files, all kinds of stuff out there. How about individual users? What do individual users usually have available to them on a shared server?
Communicate with each other, communication.
So one of the ways a network server could help us is in communication. For example, it could deploy a mail server, an email server. What are the components of an email server? Really two major components of an email server.
Send or receive information.
Okay, that's what it does. What allows it to send and receive information? How does a server know how to send and receive information? What does it have running on it?
Protocols.
It has to have some kind of application, some kind of server software. It has to have an email server software running on it. So we have the application. So in order to have an email server, we have to actually load some type of application on our server for an email server. We have to decide which one we want to use. If we're using a Microsoft server, it's Microsoft Exchange. If there's various different open source versions of IMAP and POP3, email servers that you can run on your server, and they actually provide the software code to actually know how to manage email. The other piece is we have to have data storage. We have to have place data storage to store our email messages. So we actually store all of those email messages somewhere on that central server as files. Okay. You may find that they're not, each little individual email is not necessarily stored as a file, but maybe your mailbox isn't stored as a file. So all of your emails are stored inside of that file. I guess the other one I was hoping you guys would come up with was the concept that each user has a personal storage space, a home directory space, which is a real common use of a network server, is home directory storage space. So of all these things, taking a look at data, what's the advantage of centrally stored data on a server versus, say, why don't we just keep all of our emails on our local machine and all of our word processing files and everything on our local machine? Why do we want to put stuff on a central server?
So you can have access
So everybody can access it, or anyone can access it.
A little more organized. I suppose like having multiple stuff or multiple computers and all that.
Have centralized administrators.
Okay, so when we look at everyone can access it, technically, if all of our machines are on the network, everyone can still access it. I mean, I can tell you guys how to map to my computer and access my data, and you guys can tell me how to map to yours and access your data. But it's not going to be very convenient, and it's not going to be very organized, and it's going to be a real pain if I have to try to figure out, well, who's got this data on your computer, and how do I find it?
And is that computer on and running?
And is that computer on and running, or is it accessible at the moment? What are some other advantages of putting in a central computer versus just ease of access and organization?
Mm-hmm.
How about fault tolerance?
If any given workstation goes down, if the data's not on the workstation, you're not depending on it.
Right.
It's also easier for that security-wise, because you're not having to track multiple workstations.
More controllable.
Yeah, it's more controllable. It's, when you look at something like if you put them on individual computers, every piece of data is on a different computer, and each computer is subject to failure. Their network connection might go down, their hard drive might go down, that individual user might get confused and accidentally delete the wrong file. We have a lot more error situations that can come in.
You have to back up every single computer.
Right, you'd have to back up every single computer. I mean, if you look at this room, if this was our work group, we've got like 18 some odd computers here, we'd have to make sure all 18 of these computers are on and ready to back up. Even if we were trying to run a centralized backup system, it would be a nightmare trying to make sure every single one of these got backed up. In a central server, you can run a standard backup system that will back up that server and make sure you've got your data secured. You can buy a much nicer server machine that has fault tolerance built into it, things like RAID systems so that if one hard drive dies, you don't actually lose that data. You can put it on better uninterruptible power supplies. You can put it on a better power grid. You can give it redundant network cards. You can give it redundant power supplies. You can give it all kinds of things, even to the point that you can actually have duplicate mirrored servers that if one server dies, the other one stands in for it. So you can build in all of these systems that make sure that you never have downtime in your data. It would be really hard to do that for every single workstation in our system. It allows you to centralize everything and streamline the administration process and make sure it's more secured and taken care of. What are the risks of centralizing it? What do we have to be aware of as far as risks? Security is probably the biggest one. I mean, it's not as simple as just saying, okay, everybody bring all your files, let's dump them on the central server so we can back them up, and just kind of leaving it as a free-for-all. If we did, think of it like an actual file system in a filing cabinet. You know, what if we just had banks of filing cabinets and we let everybody come in and put their stuff wherever they wanted to put it? I mean, they might be able to go find their own stuff, but nobody else is going to have a clue where they put it. Okay? So part of what we have to do in a centralized server, we have to have a plan for how we're going to manage that server. If all we did is say, okay, guys, here's our new, nice, new, brand new Linux server. Here's where it is. We have, 10 terabytes of data space. Go ahead and start storing your stuff. We would very shortly have just an absolutely incredible mess. So one of the things that we do as administrators is we have to design a plan for how we're going to manage this data. Okay. When we start looking at our server, what's kind of the first basic thing we do as far as beginning to develop a plan or a system to where we can manage user access? You did it in this chapter. You set up your users and groups. So the first thing we do is we identify who are the users going to be in our system. And we identify them. Generally, we decide that every single user gets its own individual user account. There are occasions where we do generic accounts. When you guys come in here and sit down and log in, you notice there's an account named ITE that everybody logs into. It's one generic account. It doesn't provide any storage space, but it does provide access to some resources. For example, it provides access to the test out software so that when you run it, it works. We do that because everybody's really kind of doing the same stuff in here. We don't have any need to set an individual user account. We do, however, have individual user accounts. Have you guys used your user accounts? You've been in my intro class, you did. Everybody who's a student does get an account created for them. You do have a home directory storage space, and you also have a public HTML publishing space assigned to you. Those user accounts allow you to go in, and based on user account, we can decide what exactly we want an individual to be able to access. Take a look at data. What types of data might we be storing on the server? We talked about home directory storage, personal data that each individual might need to store, whether it be letters they create, their own log sheets, data repositories, whatever it is they need to have to do their job or to do whatever function they're doing with the organization. We talked about shared data. What kind of shared data might we have on the server? Just think of organizations and examples of things. Okay, so we could have financial data, accounting data.
Human resources data.
What's probably the kind of data in human resources you might most think we'd have to secure, at least in our culture?
Well, each person's personal information and their payroll information.
What other kinds of things might organizations need to store? Just think of any kind of organization you can think of. I'm just going to get a random list up here.
Patient, client, student information.
So client or customer information? guys think? What kind of information might an organization want to store?
Procedures.
It's policies and procedures? Anything else? Let's say we're a company, I don't know, just to use a standard marketing thing that manufactures widgets. What do we want to keep? Product information? Anything else? Like manufacturing data, marketing information,
user manual,
sales data. Okay. This is kind of one of the starting points that you're going to go to when you're trying to design a network server. You've got to think about what are you going to do with that server? What kind of information, if you're looking at it being a data repository as its primary focus, what type of information are you going to need to store on that server? Once you've determined what type of information you need to store, then you need to figure out who needs to access that information. So looking here, who might need to access the accounting and the financial information? The accounting department, okay. Who might need to access the human resources data?
Human resources.
Human resources, okay. Would you want everyone to be able to see the payroll data?
No.
No? Would you necessarily want everybody in human resources to see the payroll data? So you might actually have a subset of people.
I mean, most human resources departments are subsetted into personnel and payroll. Personnel handles your information, your benefits, and payroll pretty much just processes your payroll.
And actually, payroll may have a combination of people from HR who are setting salaries and setting up benefits, and people from accounting who are responsible for actually paying the checks,
accounting department may need to access certain payroll information.
So you might have some people from both that you want to access that. Just to come on down here, you might have a sales team, and they may need to see sales data, but you might also have an upper management group that needs to see sales data. You might have a manufacturing team that needs to see the manufacturing data, but again, you might have an upper management group that needs to see the manufacturing data. Okay. This is kind of the process of beginning to get some idea what kind of groups you might need. Okay, why do we want to use groups?
That way you can add a bank of users from that group all at once, having to go through and, you know, okay, I need Sally and Joe and Mary and
permission.
Pat. And
right. What you're doing at this point is you're designing a theoretical framework for how your organization works. At this point, we're not even talking about people, okay? We could be needing to have discussions about people. We might be needing to say, okay, well, Sally in accounting and Joe in human resources are both going to need access to the payroll information. So, and there are people in human resources that don't need access to the payroll, so now we've decided we need to create another group just for payroll because they're a different subset of people. But we don't know. Sally might take another job. And just because Sally takes another job doesn't mean we don't have to have a group accessing payroll, but Sally no longer needs access to payroll. And when we start looking at those things, we start seeing the differences between designing a group that's going to have access to resources versus an individual. Because if we gave Sally and Joe access to payroll information, we've got to remember, first of all, that we gave Sally and Joe access to payroll information, because maybe Sally went on vacation and Judy was going to help with the payroll, so now we give Judy access to the payroll information. And when these people move on, we've got to go back to each of their individual user setups and make sure we change that access there. When we use groups, we can make a group called payroll. We can give them access to the payroll, and all we have to do is go to the group, give the group access to the payroll, and then go to the group and see who the members of the group are. And it's kind of already inherently built-in documentation. So if we have a group called payroll, Sally, Joe, and Judy are members of the group payroll. Because they're members of the group payroll, they're automatically going to get access to all of the data that we gave payroll access to. Now, if Sally takes another job, all we have to do is go to the group payroll, remove Sally, because Sally no longer needs access, and when we hire someone new, maybe Kevin comes in and he's going to take Sally's place, we go in and we put Kevin in the group payroll, and now all of a sudden Kevin has access to everything that he needs to do his job in payroll. What it allows us to do is in the design phase, we design the groups that are going to work together. We design what they need to have access to and determine our file structure based on what we need to give them access to. We give that group access to the correct file structures. And then that's kind of just all inherently documented for us because we can see what file systems the group has access to and we can see who are members of those groups. And then when somebody moves around, like Sally leaves and we hire Kevin, we don't have to go back through the whole thought process and think, okay, now we've hired Kevin for payroll. What is he going to need access to do his job? Okay, well, he's going to need access to this program and this program and this program and this file and this resource. We don't have to do that. All we have to do is go and say, oh, let's take Sally out of payroll and let's put Kevin in payroll. And once we've put Kevin in the group payroll, if we've set up the payroll group properly, Kevin now automatically has access to everything he needs to do his job in payroll. Now, let's say that maybe we're going to design a new product. And we want Kevin to work with the people on the manufacturing team to help determine what kind of payroll changes we're going to need to make for the people we're going to have to hire to work on the new product. All we then have to do is either create a new group to handle the things they're going to do or go down and put Kevin in the the manufacturing group so that Kevin can also work with the manufacturing group. So if we can put people in more than one group so that their access to our server are a combination of all the groups that they belong to. So now they get access to everything that they need based on their group memberships. Generally, when you're designing something, you should give most of the access at the group level and very little access at the user level. One of the things I will say is as we look through Linux, next semester we're going to get a little more deep in this and we'll look at some other things. At this level, we're looking at the file system security is a little bit rudimentary. At the Linux level. It has some limitations in what we can do as far as using the users and groups. As we look further on, you'll see there are a lot of other utilities. Like, for example, SUSE happens to be a Novell product, and Novell has a management product called eDirectory that can run on SUSE that greatly increases our flexibility in how we assign rights to files and directories. And here in Linux, we can assign read, write, and execute rights, and that's all we can assign at the file and directory system. And if we use something like eDirectory, we get a whole nother list of rights we can assign. We can give people browse rights. We can give people the ability to write to something without actually being able to see it. We can do all kinds of, we have lots more fine-tuned security available to us than we're actually seeing at this moment. Let me ask you this. What do you guys think the most important component of a network is? Most important component of a network. The router? Anybody else have any ideas? What? What is the whole point of the network? Or the server, or anything that we're doing in building a network server in a network?
Communication
between?
Between computers.
Between people.
Okay, there you go. Between who?
People,
users. Your users are your most important component of your network. If you don't have users, you don't have a point to having your network or your server. That is your most important point. What this section here is about is about how to give your users access to the resources they need. One of the things to keep in mind when you're designing security, it's interesting, different operating systems take different viewpoints. Most Linux-based operating systems kind of come from the viewpoint that they give a user very limited access until we give them additional access, which, in my opinion, I like better as an administrator. One of my things I've learned from experience is my users will let me know when they can't access something they need access to. Very, very seldom does a user come tell me, oh, I have access to something I shouldn't have. To tell you a little story, years ago before I came to Santa Fe, I did a year-long consulting job with an organization that was converting their entire environment from a Macintosh environment to a PC-based environment. So we were deploying Microsoft SQL servers with a document management system. We were employing a Novell server to handle the file and print services, and converting everything over. And it was an association of accounting firms. So they had a full-time person on staff that had been there like internal accountant, and they'd sent him away to training, and he was going to be their on-site network administrator, and my job was to come in and train him and help him get through the process of converting everything over and get everybody up in training. And so he had done some of the initial setup on his own, and I was doing a security review of the setup. Well, one of the things I discovered is that everybody in the entire organization had access to human resources data, personnel data, and payroll data. And I went to him and I said, hey, I just discovered this, and I discovered basically what's happening is everyone has been given access at the very root of the file system where all the human resources data has been installed. And I assumed that possibly this had happened when they were installing their accounting systems. They were running something like Solomon Accounting or something. And I said it might have been done in the initial installation process to make it easier to get the system up and running, but then the security needed to be fine-tuned from there. And what's really kind of interesting, when you work with large-based network products, we in here are learning how to manage just a Linux system. But when you start adding applications to that, something like an accounting system or a web-based system or various others, some of those products are designed to integrate with the operating system. So in this case, the accounting system is designed to integrate with the operating system. So when you go inside of the accounting system and you set up your accounting users and you give them, say, for example, access to the payroll data, it has little routines, the fingers that feed back through to the operating system that adjust the security at the operating system. And that's the proper way to set up a package like this. And then after you've set up your accounting system package, you can actually go back in and look at the rights and stuff given to users in the operating system, and you'll see all those new assignments that were created by the software. And I looked through it, and I said, well, here's the problem. I don't think that the software's ever been set up properly with the correct permissions. And he was sure it was, so I went ahead and took off the global assignment that had been given to everyone to give everybody rights. And sure enough, 2 days later, they went to print payroll, and they could not function. Nobody had ever been given rights to that piece. So we had to go back through and go through the accounting system and edit everything and make sure everybody had been given proper security. So to me, that's kind of an example that I like to use of where you've got to be very careful about the way you do security. Yes, it was easy for someone when they were installing that accounting package to go give everybody global rights to everything so that they could make sure that the software itself worked. And yes, the software did work, but it also made everything totally vulnerable. Anybody in the company could have gone in and with just a delete key deleted the entire accounting system database. That's how insecure it was. And it would have just simply been gone. So you want to be real careful when you're signing assignments. Sometimes it's easy to go up really high in your file system, give everybody a full access, and yeah, everything works great, everything works fine, but you've really left a lot of vulnerability in your system. So you have to start from kind of the lowest level down and give the least amount of rights you can possibly give until you fine-tune and figure out what everybody does really need. That's an important thing to look at. Okay, so in this chapter, you're actually creating users, you're creating groups, you're seeing some of the basics of how to go to a directory and a file system to give them rights, and you've seen some of that. It's going into chapter 3, which you're working on now, getting ready to turn in. You're actually managing the physical hard drive space. Why is it so important to understand? I mean, you guys have all worked on desktops, and probably very few of you have ever used FDisk on your desktop to create new partitions and to manage partitions of your desktop. Some of you might have. But in a network server, why is it so critical to understand those components?
Because it wipes it out.
Well, it does wipe it out, but which is not something you want to do with a network server. But what is the difference in dynamics between the way a network server functions between a desktop environment? You got any ideas?
More after like command line.
Have you guys ever looked at one of these servers? We have little tiny servers back here. Have you ever looked at one? In a minute, I'll take you back and show you. If you open up the front, you're going to see like 5 or 6 drive bays in those servers. And those are just basic level, entry level servers. When we're storing all of this centralized data we talked about, think about how much data storage you store on your little personal computer. If you start putting all that to a centralized system and you're managing a huge company, think about the amount of data you're going to be storing. And we're talking huge chunks of data, terabytes and more of data. We're also talking about data repositories that are going to continue to grow. You don't really, a lot of that you keep forever, depending on what it is. If you're a hospital and you're keeping patient records, your patient records just grow and grow and grow and grow, and you need bigger and bigger and bigger storage areas. So the difference between managing the amount of data you have on a workstation and the amount of data you have on the server is exponentially larger on the server. So you're managing multiple drives, as well as you're managing a scenario where you're going to continue to add drive space over the life of that server. So as an administrator, this is something that you are going to deal with when you're managing a server, is how to manage the physical drive space before you get it ready to begin then allocating directories and files and write structures to your users and groups. So it's more important in a server environment than it is in just a workstation environment. Okay. That's pretty much all I had on my notes for this chapter, just to go over. Anybody have questions or thoughts or comments?
Not yet.
Not yet?
But she said. I haven't got it yet. I
just
started it today.
Well, What I'm going to be doing each week in class is kind of a similar type of thing, helping you guys understand the concepts and theory behind what you're doing versus just the commands to do it. Because if you don't understand why you're creating groups and you don't get the kind of the big picture for why you're creating groups, it's just commands at the command line. And you really need to understand.
Well,
we really need to kind of talk about that.
You got to segregate people now.